Blog Talk Radio.
Sometimes the slickest thing that I see in my day is the is the sun coming up, the spring wrapping itself around us. It's a wonderful time of life where I am, and I hope that extends in some measure to where you are. It's the spring here, and I am never forgetful of the listeners in the Southern Hemisphere, the top of the earth, as they like to remind us, looking at fall and winter coming. So much change. At the same time, we're moving at different points along that big, big orbit, that big path. I've been looking at some graphic illustrations of the universe as we know it, as the planets, the Milky Way and our planets, our planetary system revolving around the star. And there's some things that fascinate me. Instead of looking at this as if I'm somebody has painted it on a plate, and we're a plate of glass, and we are looking down at it or obliquely at it. Where our star is also moving through space, and everything being relative, our positions being relative, we see things at fixed points where we're able to predict. But the planets are moving along this parade in a spiral. If you think about it, the orbit is stretched out in beautiful spirals, different, affected by gravitational forces and the whether the big planets, gaseous planets, or have more core, or the heat, proximity to our star. Sorry, doesn't take much to amaze me anymore. Except I'm like that fan of chess when I look over your shoulder when you're playing, and I know enough about the game to be amazed with your dexterity, and when I am able to see the potential of your strategy, I do become excited, and I always wish, my goodness, this seems so obvious. Why can't I do it when I sit to the board? I absolutely love that sense of order, what it brings to mind. And today, we're going to attempt in our own humble way to talk with you more about the culture of Freemasonry. Had to come to grips with the notion that my fascination, the fascination of many people around, is with this understated, often ignored aspect of the craft, the culture. How we get there and who we are and how we, more than practice, more than, I can practice and I can give up things and dedicate myself, but I can also step back, and I will, although hopefully I'll grow my mentors and teachers, just like I try when if I'm mentoring somebody, I expect them to surpass my ability to, stand on my shoulders, like I'm standing on somebody else's shoulders. To pause. Remember the excitement, the interest. When I was, it took a violin class at the university many years ago. I fell in with a bunch of people whose primary study was music. And it was like watching you play chess. You could walk through past a practice studio and hear somebody playing Bach or Chopin Nocturne, or somebody with a bass, an upright bass, performing arpeggios and cellists and horn players, all practicing, all with the beautiful, beautiful pieces of music. And to hear it was like this, you walk from one piece of music into this, through these membranes into the next piece of music. And as you keep walking past the doors, you hear, it just never ends. And it's like, made me pay attention. Something serious going on here. And what was lovely, when I walked in fretting that I was going to be lost in this atmosphere, the professor explained to everybody that we're all here as your second instrument. Nobody was there that was studying violin as their primary instrument. You had to have a second instrument. So everybody was a neophyte in that regard. And it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. You can imagine after going from, picking up your violin at the shop, within 6 weeks playing a piece of Mozart. Ha! But the best was to play it together as this whole group, maybe 15 or 20 of us. It was, and the celebration was just, how to do it. You can bend a note on a different instrument, but when you're with the playing something that expresses a tone with the intimacy of a violin, being able to achieve it and knowing everybody is, the whole group is thinking that way, as the professor would often say, tap, 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 there's no reward for being first. We even had to learn to hit the note on the beat. Charming, stimulating and inspiring. Still stays with me to this day. And yeah, I did pass the course, by the way. Yes, I'm still a fan. I no longer play violin, but as he explained to me, it was the age. You need to, if you're going to do something with a violin, you need to start it when you were a child, 8, 9, 10, 11, in that range. I was well into my 30s and could do it as a hobby, as he said. So anyway, here we sit looking at the development of capacities around us, this is a tremendous challenge. And I know that there's people that might find getting up in the morning and presenting themselves is the challenge, and rightfully so, given their impediments, that's fine. But at some point, some of us want to go beyond getting through the basics and actually express a development to work on ourselves and to understand ourselves. And when we find that in order to do that, we have the advantage of the writings and notions of some significant minds. It's not to put us into our place, but to present a context for us to explore our own thoughts and ideas, or to make our own decisions. And so, wherever do you stop, and how do you find that the influence of the philosophers in history fits in is left to you. No one else does it, and that's the uniqueness. That's the specificity of the world as you see it from your eyes. It's why I still want to ensure that the world around me has an opportunity to realize the difference between fact and opinion, and to embrace them and understand them for what they are. I wouldn't use a chainsaw if I needed to use a scalpel. What am I going to do? I'm going to criticize the manufacturers of a good scalpel when I'm trying to cut down a tree? Well, it's what instrument do you need? I suppose you could get there, but I don't understand it. So if you're in a given day, you can read Dostoevsky and understand. It's not just reading him. It's like picking out the pearls, or Nietzsche, and understanding, or Spinoza, and understanding their thinking and making connections. I've often thought, I understand. Yeah, I get that. Or I completely disagree. Or more likely, I've heard very bad things about this person and their thinking, and yet the history here, fact-based history, seems to contradict what I've heard. Hey, what's going on? Well, it's quite a bit. The world is quite a bit different when you strive to understand and reason and come to terms with the truth of things, what actually happened, not what we want to believe happened. But we judge in the meantime as honestly as we possibly can. Here, this program is dedicated to those who have appreciated the difficulty and the benefit of waiting until you're the last one, to be the last one in the room to speak. After, it's a discipline. You want to jump in, you want to say whatever is on your mind, but you don't. You pause. You wait for everybody in the room to speak first. I want to tell you that it was the writing of a philosopher that taught me this. But the reveal is back in the 90s, early 90s, I was working with Inuit people. And one of the old camp leaders, very, very smart man, would advise me. It was a wonderful gig, like working in National Geographic. And he taught me. We went to important town meetings. And he waited 2 days before he spoke, knowing full well that people were expecting him to have ideas and to implement them for the betterment of everybody. He was really quite a bright man. 2 days. He was attentive. He was always there a little bit early. Stayed, and these were meetings that went on, 16, 18 hours, hardly a break. So I paid attention. It was one of those lessons that you stumble across in life. And I'm sure you have your own versions of those important lessons. When you think about it, a gathering of men, I don't know, would they call us a parliament of masons? No, that's owls, isn't it? A murder of masons? No, that's crows. When you put together that kind of group of men, would you even wonder what was going to happen? When you slide into conversation comfortably, without the self-consciousness of somebody trying to make a point, that the experience, and you've had that experience is the culture of masonry. And I can't imagine being surprised that there are people around the world that want to savor that environment. Of course, if we ever began to create a bureaucracy, wouldn't it be wonderful to see how the extent to apply this thinking to every nation in the world? Well, my goodness, we already have. We already have. The endurance of all of that is perhaps the magical part, or mystery part. To validate the Masonic experience is to understand the process of adaptability. Now that's not easy especially for people clinging to a validation that comes that's been often erroneously translated or interpreted, I should say. Been passed on with that whispered game that children play. You have a message and you whisper it into the ear of the person to your right, and it goes around the circle, becomes indecipherable very quickly. It's like that. Bringing it back to clarity, bringing it back into focus is the benefit of our historians and philosophers. So today, this is an amazing celebration. I won't delay. Here we start the program today with some music. This is what does music do for us? Soothes us and focuses us and brings us together. It's like breathing. This is Horace Silver, his tune, Only Lonely Woman. Thank you. capacities. The culture of Freemasonry has been with us for centuries. If only we could know the influence it has brought to bear on the world. The generations who have lived through disaster walk amongst us with awareness. Who is to say, given the laws of probability, that we can't be completely caught by surprise that bad things happen? Preparation is always in mind. How best to prepare while still carrying on our routines? And so it goes for nations that struggle with ethical development. More questions than answers. More confusion than challenge. Inevitably, we return to a reset point without the posturing of absolutism, perhaps with the jaundiced thoughts of a politician, but always with a sense that tomorrow we will be better off because we have been reminded the consequences of disrespecting the laws of nature. Not that Freemasonry is exclusive. But among the various claims of salvation, it has claimed moral high ground without the piety, as if doing right was as natural as breathing. How this fares in a materialist economy is what we are trying to answer today. Even prayer is a commodity. Faith-based practices, as they tend to be, have been used as leverage. Leaders with self-serving motives that once would have scandalized nations have crept into scene. Everything is in play at all times without only reason to divide us between order of a sort and chaos. Freemasonry. It teaches us the advantage of listening quietly, being the last to speak, waiting to hear from all the others, knowing their opinions before speaking. Valuing. It's like that supposition that we attain, the way we attain knowledge is by doing it socially. Not altogether comfortable with that notion yet. We are plunging into that debate, but we are influencing decision makers. Our presence is a symbol of continuity to the world as we continue to take seriously attitudes and manners that swirl and spiral around us in order to understand. We are adding capacity through our studies and devotion to the learnings of Freemasonry. By doing that, we ground the thinking of entire populations, even those who disagree that we should exist. In a way, it's a sacrifice that seems the right thing to do. We're that piece of flotsam that's washed up on the shore, a reminder of a past so long ago it's out of memory. And that that gesture itself is an affirmation. We have been here that long. We might even assume we'll be here that much longer. You go about your work, knowing and know that your reading, the questioning, building your capacity, reasoning through the debate is extending a capacity that wouldn't otherwise be realized. Your contribution. could either pour another glass and sit back and listen to the work of Scott Hamilton, or get on with our task today. Although having your company and talking does have a certain appeal, but no, we have work to do. It's interesting that when people want to do something, instead of just declaring that it's on their mind and something that they prefer for whatever reason, they will often embellish, go on at great lengths, usually with aggression to make their point, embellishing the value of one thing and the counterpoint, embellishing the story of the wrongness of others that have a contrary opinion. Ego is a really, really interesting phenomena. It's a way of defining a process. Something that permeates personality, and that is apart from decision-making and reacting to the world around us, although it has something to do with it. And it can go off the rails. Yeah, we understand that these days. We have a greater understanding. We're no longer shooting cowards fleeing from the trauma of the trench. Nope. We've come a little way in that regard. The poets of the world continue to expose their hearts and minds to the ruthlessness of the world around, for the sake of sharing and hoping to enlighten us or to alert us to a deeper understanding of ourselves, of what it takes to be a human, what it is to be a human being. They use a language that it connects. The work today is from a very significant poet. And to explain this, I need to tell you, I'll just talk to you a little bit about a mystical branch of Islam, Sufism. Sufism is a Sufi, is a Muslim who seeks annihilation of the ego. The idea originated, I'm told, after the death of Muhammad, may peace be with him, in 632. But it did not develop into orders until the 12th century. The orders were formed around spiritual founders who gained saint status and shrines built in their names. It's still with us today. It's still a counterpoint, isn't it? Mystical belief. What do you think? The idea of Masonry was established well before orders were formed for us. Anyway, that's a silly distraction here. Rumi. This is considered, even when we have developed nations in the West taking a very hard stance on refugees. Hard to believe. The I'm told the best-selling poet in the southern part of North America is Rumi. Rumi. This is an Afghan man. He had to flee his homeland from Mongol invaders 700 years ago, and he went on to write the one thing that nobody can take from you is your education and your talents. He began to write. He wrote volumes of poems about life and loss. And it's said that we have entered an era where our emotions consume us, our ideologies divide us, and our culture binds us, and our beliefs build barriers. Yet we all share a humbling commonality with all other life forms, including the lowly bacteria we breathe. So here, this is a fellow who wrote about that. They're uncanny. The poetry, you can sample it yourself. I'm sure you can Google it, or you may have a volume of it sitting on your shelf. The startling nature is the relevance, because he's speaking to the human in us, not the differences. Here, I'll just give you a sample, where to begin, where to end. This is how he has done that. This is a sample. So and he's telling us, of course, about how we can be blinded by our differences. And it's easy to forget we're all the same. We may not share the same principles and values, but the core idea we collectively fight for is the strength to protect our communities. And his suggestion is, ultimately, there's only one community. Global breathing. Listen to this poem and tell me if you find that if he speaks to you in this way. Not Christian or Jew or Muslim, not Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi, or Zen. Not any religion or cultural system. I am not from the East or the West. Not out of the ocean or up from the ground. Not natural or ethereal. Not composed of elements at all. I do not exist. I'm not an entity in this world or in the next. Did not descend from Adam and Eve or any origin story. My place is placeless, a trace of the traceless. Neither body or soul. I belong to the beloved, have seen the two worlds as one, and that one called to and know first, last, outer, inner, only that breath, breathing human being. Remarkable, hmm? Here's what he says about fear. A donkey turning a millstone is not trying to press oil from sesame seed. He is fleeing the blow that was just struck and hoping to avoid the next. We look to ease our pain, and this keeps civilization moving along. Fear is the architect here. Fear keeps us working near the arc. Sometimes, though, it is fear, the contracting, that brings you into the presence. That's his poem, The Uses of Fear. Oh, I don't expect that you immediately pause and assume a position, go about your day pondering this. I would hope that in the course of your travels, when you're doing something that you've done 100 times before, that you allow your thoughts to wander to the words and find a phrase that speaks to you or doesn't, that is provocative or not. And then think about the point that he was trying to make. He was talking about universality. 7th century Afghani philosopher, Muslim philosopher, Sufi, working to annihilate the ego. I think in so many ways that our Masonic culture is an approximation of this. Do we judge it at arm's length, or do we pursue it, examine it for ourselves, sample it, do it, and then evaluate the merit for ourselves? Does it have merit to continue on or not? No one can make that decision for you, for us. But what if we see the possibilities? What if there is a possibility and it's not known, and the only way you find out is by doing the work?
Thank you.
This notion of universality is kind of interesting. It's like historians catches up in our own myths and beliefs and practices. Oh, we want to believe that we are extending universality, and perhaps in some ways we are. But we also have this notion that we want to keep Freemasonry looking and sounding like me. I don't mean me, but of self. That's continuity. As Rumi would tell us, it's fear. What we don't understand. History is never unkind. That's a value statement, but it is stark. A good history will improve our sense of and the accuracy of our thinking. Here, we learn that we're talking here in this part of the British Masonic visions and history of some interesting observations. I don't mean the tedium of dates and somebody's name. They were here at a particular time. Well, I never found that did much for me. I always tend to need to understand why they were there. And if I'm going to remember somebody's name, why? You know, it's like buying running shoes that have the proper acceptable brand. Yeah, well, you're listening to a man whose favorite old rock tune is Like a Rolling Stone. Remember that, Dylan tune?
Yeah.
The Masonic vision of true wisdom. Let me give you a version and then you can digest it as you will. But by definition, the private illuminations of the saint or the mystic. For the Freemason, knowledge must be achieved socially. To a point, I would agree. And yet the members of this society must be carefully chosen so as to permit it to maintain its secrets. Within this homogeneous system of values, the unique insights proclaimed by the religious enthusiast as a result of his or her special communication with God are simply irrelevant to the fraternal experience and discipline of the lodge. There is no body of 18th century literature more systematically at odds with the religiosity of the 17th century Protestant sects or the piety of traditional Catholicism or the new Methodism than that of Freemasonry. In the British context, this secular stance was noticeable enough. In the midst of continental Calvinism or Catholicism, Masonic religiosity could easily give offense. The first narrative history of Freemasonry in French in 1738 allied the order with the English Revolution, but it specifically condemned the enthusiastic sects of the 1650s. That's speaking about the religious wars. If we look at the religious landscape of 18th century Britain, we begin to see the distinctive quality of Masonic religiosity. After the Act of Toleration, there still existed legal discrimination against non-Anglican Protestants. That was when the rights were given. Catholics and anti-Trinitarians, as well as atheists, had never been covered by the Act. Among Protestant dissenters, sectarian and even enthusiastic religious movements remained commonplace enough. Not least from the late 1730s on, Methodism made many converts among people, men and women, disaffected by the perceived laxity and worldliness of the established Anglican Church. In this context, the Masonic insistence upon religious toleration, it goes something like, a Mason is obliged to that religion in which all men agree. In other words, it's keep your opinions, your particular opinions, to yourself. And that stood in contrast to the discrimination imposed upon Protestant dissenters and Catholics and anti-Trinitarians by law and custom. It's not our place. We do not know if dissenters were particularly attracted to the lodges because of their relevant relative tolerance, but French Huguenots seemed exceptionally commonplace, particularly in the London lodges. The fact that they were condemned in France and chased out by the Queen. Yet the ethos of Freemasonry could not be further removed from the intense piety, even revivalism, of the sectarian or the Methodist. Anglican piety had never abandoned belief in the natural depravity of humankind and in the inability of human beings to merit salvation. The Masonic emphasis on the perfectibility of the human condition, on the ideals of harmony, order, and merit, if only in the lodge, set forth a secular oasis. It was a distinctively optimistic place by comparison with any of the human conditions described by the varieties of English Protestantism. Yet Masonry could also have an openly Christian face. As one orator put it in 1737, the Church of Christ is a society of spiritual Masonry, select from the world, corresponding by outward signs. The abandonment of the millenarian and the sectarian occurred within high culture primarily in the 1690s after the establishment of 1689 of constitutional monarchy and parliamentary government. In that decade, both Whigs and Tories who accepted the settlement did so with the self-confidence of knowing that parliamentary rights had been secured without social upheaval or reform, without turning the world upside down. Such turning had long been associated with the millenarian dreams of the radical sectaries of the 1650s, with what early modern Europeans, right up to 1789, called enthusiasm. The demise of lower class radicalism consigned the millennial dream, once fashionable even in reformist Anglican circles, to the fantasies of the disconnected and disenfranchised. Thank you. kind of ironic. We're playing Lou Donaldson's You've Changed. Yeah, we've changed. But have we? I mean, you know, these bits of history and ideas flow to us philosophically and strangely iridescent in the hands of a poet, in the mind of a poet, matter when it matters to us. If you can be forgiven for thinking that it's all a bit overwhelming. It is. Understanding, isn't it competition? How you go about your business, and how you learn is unique to you. I can remember when I was learning my craft, one old psychiatrist, a professor, talking about that, how most people in some way, again, when measured against a standard, most everybody has some quirkiness or learning disability that they master all on their own. You prevail in spite of that. It's an interesting concept. It's how do you prove it, of course, you know. But it's an interesting concept. But it brings up the old notion of elasticity, that we adapt. And the more we know, the more we do the research, the more we're uncovering surprises, answers, and changing assumptions. I hope you go about your business with an energy in your step. And find time for yourself. Not to feed the ego, but to understand it. You can do that without drawing attention to yourself. If you need to draw attention, if that's what brings quality to your life, go ahead. But the more you understand, the more you have that sense of control. Until you get to the point where you realize that it's an illusion, right? Yeah. It's been very interesting today, bringing you the history, this portion of history about our roots, coming to terms with the secular environment, our practices that spill out of that, and this notion that our order formed much after, hundreds of years after the idea. Well, of course it did. And you and I are an extension of that process. And we can't deny that that we are a small cohort moving forward. Yeah. Fascinating as it is, just remarkable. Today, you, and for the rest of the week until we can get together again, you find that Masonic presence that you've been yearning for. And I sincerely thank you for sitting in with us. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.